everyone. I'm Jim Nintzel, Tucson's Sentinel government and political impact reporter, and I'm sitting in for the legendary Bill Buckmaster here on The Buckmaster Show. It's Wednesday, May 14th, and producer Tom Fairbanks is across the window from me here in the Green Things Zocalo Village studio. Later in today's show, we'll be talking to Merrill Kemp Wilcox, the director of research and development for Pima County JTED. That's the Joint Technical Education District, which offers career and technical training for high school students in Southern Arizona. Then we'll talk with Lisa Schnebly-Heidinger and Julie Morrison, authors of the new book, Arizona Friend Trips, Stories from the Road, a book that explores Arizona in prose, poetry, and photography. But first, we're going to start with author Gary Paul Navam, an author, ethnobotanist, and MacArthur Fellow who founded the seed bank organization Native Seeds Search. His latest book is Against the American Grain, A Borderlands History of Resistance, which tells the story of residents of the border regions who inspired revolutionary movements. Among the people Navam profiles are Cabeza de Vaca, Woody Guthrie, Tim Z. Hernandez, John Steinbeck, Ed Ricketts, Cesar Chavez, Dolores Huerta, Lalo Guerrero, and John Fife. Welcome to the Buckmaster Show, Gary.
It's great to be with you, Jim.
So talk a little bit about what inspired you to write this book.
Well, living in southern Arizona for most of the last half century, I ran into descendants or the people themselves that are in the book that I realized after years of knowing them had made history here in the borderlands that spilled out all over North America. And so I wanted to capture how those characters were shaped by this desert landscape.
And why do you think these stories are important to hear today?
Well, a lot of people are using the word resistance today because of the divisiveness we've had in our country the last decade. And I am not talking so much about political resistance, but cultural resistance, artistic resistance, and even the use of humor to resist and challenge the status quo and the divisiveness in our country. I think we need to resist the forces that are trying to divide us.
And can you talk a little bit, you know, one of my favorite chapters in this is the story of, I'm a huge John Steinbeck fan from my teen years on. And he wrote, he traveled with a marine biologist, Ed Ricketts, into the Gulf of California, all the way from their docks up there in California, and did quite a survey of the marine life of the Gulf of California. And can you talk a little bit about what you found fascinating about what those guys did?
Well, both Steinbeck and Ricketts, to some extent, came out of social justice context, especially Steinbeck. In the years before he went down to the Sea of Cortez, he really helped shape American policy about farm workers and immigrants and all of that through his friendship with Eleanor Roosevelt and others. But when he teamed up with Ricketts, an incredible ecologist of the coasts of Mexico and California, he went another step further and brought environmental justice and social justice together. And his inspiration really helped shape the conservation movement in Mexico that then has protected dozens of islands and coastal areas in the Gulf of California, just south of Arizona. And so people tend to see Steinbeck for one gift that he had versus the other, the story telling about the poor outcasts and migrants that hit California in the do-re-mi days of the Dust Bowl and Depression. But he had just as much of an impact on environmental conservation in Western North America.
And Ed Ricketts, who was his companion on that trip, was the inspiration for Doc in Cannery Row, if I understand correctly.
That's right, and an inspiration for other people as well, from Joseph Campbell to Robinson Jeffers, a great California poet, and inspired many women, I guess, too, because every day in Monterey, California, there are women who still put flowers on his grave where a railroad engine hit his car over 60 years ago, 70 years ago. So Ricketts, like Steinbeck, is alive and well in many people's hearts.
One of the other chapters you talk about was one that you had some personal involvement, and that was the sanctuary movement that started here in Southern Arizona way back in the late 1970s and ended up with a federal trial in the 1980s in regards to the sheltering of undocumented immigrants traveling here from Central America. Can you talk a little bit about the sanctuary movement and how you were involved with it?
Well, what most people don't know is that the people who began the sanctuary movement, like John Fife, were very much engaged, perhaps on river trips and camping trips, with the people who started the collaborative conservation movement with Malpai Borderlands in southeastern Arizona, and Ed Abbey and Dave Foreman, who both lived in Tucson, of course. And so there was, when I first came to Tucson, there was a dialogue between all those people. And my first garden in Tucson was with Jim Corbett and his wife and a bunch of people who now live out in Cascabel, Tom Orme and Nancy Ferguson, among others. And in the discussions, I began to realize that Jim Fife was a great goat walker and gardener, but he had other things going on in his head and clandestinely on his trips to Mexico. And so Jim and John are like saints to me. They were both so generous to me, but I played just a minuscule role in helping write up refugee status papers and hosting a Guatemalan family during those days who were working on their papers. But to be a fly on the wall and see how the sanctuary movement grew from something in Tucson and Berkeley to the whole country, 800 churches, synagogues, and mosques, and over 20,000 clergy involved in the idea of sanctuary, was just a remarkable way to understand the value of our region to the rest of the world.
Do you think there are lessons from that movement that are important today as we see this crackdown on undocumented immigrants and refugees?
I do, and I think it will not take the shape that it did in the past. There's a new great book that I recommend to everyone called Sanctuary Everywhere that says we need to not pattern ourselves exactly after that movement in the late 70s through the 90s, but look at other ways to do that. And my notion is that there's over $10 million of what are called faith lands, lands that churches, synagogues, and mosques and Buddhist centers own in the Intermountain West because people have willed it to them, that can be a temporary sanctuary or haven for people who are legally trying to get their paperwork done, but are afraid to stay at their workplace or in their homes because of unjustified attempts to pull them out of the rural communities where they've helped bring us food security. So I think all of us who care about food security, the health and welfare of rural residents have to pitch in and help find these people sanctuary anywhere until this dark storm in America blows over.
You know, your last book before this one was Agave Spirits, The Past, Present, and Future of Mezcals. And you won a James Beard Award for that one. Can you give us a takeaway about tequila that our listeners might not know?
Well, you make me sound like a schizophrenic, Jim, that I can take on two different topics in the same couple years, but the agaves interest me because they know how to resist the challenges of living in a desert world, and they do that in a way that brings us this remarkably flavorful set of products, including tequila, bacanora, mezcal, raicia, that are the distilled essence of the desert in my mind. So it's not a reach for me to be interested in how deserts resist drought, heat, climate change, and poor soil conditions, and how people in deserts have resisted daunting challenges and somehow transcended them.
No, I don't think I had heard about Bacanora until about 15 years ago when my drinking days were mostly behind me. But that's a really interesting spirit, isn't it?
Yes, and I don't drink much anymore, but I'm really interested in the history of mezcal in Arizona and Sonora, including that Julius Rosenbaum had a bottling plant in Old Town Tucson, a few blocks away from the police station. Probably the police in the 1890s were his biggest customers. But he also had land in southern Arizona and Sonora where people would roast wild agaves and then by horseback wagons bring those up to Tucson to be rebottled and then distributed elsewhere. So Tucson's really part of the history of introduction of mezcals to the United States. And of course, as you know, we had agaves being used for food and fiber by Native Americans here going back millennia and had about 120,000 acres of agaves in cultivation prehistorically in the Tucson Basin. So it's something that we really need to celebrate as part of our binational traditions and legacy.
All right. Well, Gary, I'm going to let you go. I really appreciate you coming on here. Our guest has been Gary Paul Nabhan, who's the author of Against the American Grain, A Borderlands History of Resistance, as well as the James Beard Award-winning book, Agave Spirits, The Past, Present, and Future of Mezcals. Gary, thank you so much for joining us, and we will be right back after this commercial break.
The Green Valley News and Sarita Sun cover two of Arizona's most desirable communities. The News and Sun's media reach 75% of the region through newspapers, websites, social media, video, newsletters, and more. They also produce more than a dozen print and digital magazines annually for an audience of 70,000. Find them at gvnews.com. The Green Valley News and Sarita Sun, covering your hometown.
This is Bill Buckmaster urging my listeners to join me in becoming a member of the Reed Park Zoo, one of America's top zoos and home to more than 300 animals from all over the world. When you become a zoo member, you receive free daytime admission, discounts on special events and education programs, and so much more. Find out more about zoo membership and everything you need to know about your zoo visit, reedparkzoo.org.
This is your captain speaking. Thank you for flying with Tucson International Airport, where you can avoid the hassles, long lines, and the expensive parking of the Phoenix Airport. Skip the traffic, breeze through security, and park with ease, all while supporting your community. Every flight from TUS brings more destinations and better connections right here to Tucson. So next time you're planning a getaway, remember, fly easy, fly local, fly TUS. This is your captain signing off. We're cleared for takeoff.
Vero Amore, where every certified authentic Neapolitan wood-fired pizza, pasta, panini, and salad is homemade using the finest local and imported ingredients. Vero Amore is located in the lovely Plaza Palomino at Swan and Fort Lowell. Also, check out the full catering menu and mobile pizza truck for parties and events. Vero Amore on the web at veroamorepizza.com.
The
Regional Transportation Authority's 20-year plan is funded by a half-cent sales tax through June 2026. The funding has led to a $1.6 billion investment in regional transportation improvements over the past two decades to improve your quality of life. The RTA is working on a final draft of a new regional transportation plan for future voter consideration. The $2.46 billion draft plan includes roadway, transit, safety, bicycle, pedestrian, environmental, and other needed improvements. Learn more at rtanext.com. Nestled in the foothills of the Santa Rita Mountains of southeastern Arizona is Equine Voices and Sanctuary, home to horses and burros that were rescued from neglect, abuse, abandonment, and slaughter. Please consider Equine Voices Rescue and Sanctuary with a financial gift of support and estate remembrance. Learn more about our vision and values at equinevoices.org.
We're back with the Buckmaster Show, broadcasting from the Green Things Zocalo Village Studio. I'm Jim Ninsel, the Government and Political Impact Reporter with the Tucson Sentinel. And I want to remind listeners that support for this program comes from PCOA, where the hidden costs of aging, like loneliness, falls, and financial stress, don't go unnoticed. PCOA connects older adults to critical support that helps them age safely at home. Learn more at pcoa.org. Joining me now in the Green Things Zocalo Village studio is Merrill Kemp Wilcox, the Director of Research and Development for Pima JTED, which offers career and technical training for high school students in Southern Arizona. Welcome to the Buckmaster Show, Merrill.
I'm so pleased to be here. Thank you for having us.
And for folks who are familiar with Pima JTED, it stands for Joint Technical Education District.
There you
right?
go. You got okay. it. You got it.
You offer more than 30 areas of study, from medical courses to welding to construction and the culinary arts, for sophomores, juniors, and seniors in high school.
That's right.
Talk about why this kind of career and technical training is so important.
Oh, gosh. Well, first of all, because it works. It works for the students. Not only do they get to cut their teeth in a field that they're interested in, that is aligned with our regional economic development goals, our workforce needs, and all that. That's true of career and technical education writ large. But what is also true is that students who participate in this type of training graduate high school. They graduate at over 20 percentage points higher than students who don't. And so in a community where broadly our high school graduation rates hover in the sort of mid to low 70s, JTED completers graduate at 98%. Students who participate in career and technical education just have a better foundation to start their future with. And it makes sense if you think about it. I mean, if I was in a really cool drone class, or if I was in a learning to weld and every day I was thinking about my future and I was putting my hands on the equipment and I was making cool stuff, and the price I had to pay for that was that maybe I had to sit through my math class and my foreign language, but I really loved my graphic art, you know, whatever it is, then you go to school. And you go to school and you finish.
And talk about what students walk away with when they're done with this.
This year, we're actually, you talk about walking away, we're about to celebrate our completion ceremony. We don't award high school diplomas. We are not the high school. We don't do the comprehensive academic piece. All we do is the career and technical education piece. And so when students complete with us, it means they have completed their courses in career and technical education, and they're getting their certificates. And those certificates, those awards, it's not like a homegrown internal gold star, you did it, you made it through the class kind of an award. They get certificates of value from third party national, national standards, NCCER. They get their board certified licensed nursing assistant, board certified cosmetology. They get their OSHA 10. They get, you know, external certificates of value. So they really are identified in partnership with industry of what makes sense, what is a valuable entry-level credential that would make someone stand out to you as an employer if a young person came in and said, hey, I did this training, I have this cert, I want to get a job. Those are the certifications that we teach to, and those are the certifications that our students have the opportunity to complete.
So they can get a job out of high school if they want to, or they can use it to move forward in higher ed at a community college or a university.
Absolutely.
Or both, I guess.
And most of our students are doing both. We definitely have students who go straight into work, and we, like I said, we build our programs in close concert with industry to make sure we're giving them, you know, I don't know what you need to make it as a heavy equipment operator, but people know that and we train for that. And so we make sure that we are getting real input as to what are the skills, what are the credentials, again, of value. But what we see happen with most of our students is that they do go on to post-secondary. That might be at the community college, that might be at the university, but they're in a position to work their way through it.
And they have some skin in the game.
Absolutely.
They have some knowledge of the topic that they're pursuing.
Oh, sure. And we see students who, for example, we have people who love helping people and are really inspired by the health and medical community. But when they come into our programs, they figure out that they don't really want to touch people that much. And so before they ever had to go pay tuition anywhere, they have the opportunity to say, okay, so maybe nursing isn't for me. Maybe let me look at social and mental health. Let me look at pharmacy tech. Let me look at other opportunities that are better fits. And they've sort of already had the opportunity to do that by participating in our programs before they've been either accepting jobs that maybe aren't good fits or pursuing credentials and paying tuition for things that maybe aren't good fits. It helps them really hone down what do they want, where do they fit, and spend some time getting to know what's the industry like, what's the pathway look like, how do I move forward.
So it may turn them on to a passion they have or show them that maybe they don't have a passion, but they can work in another area within that field if that fits better.
Absolutely. You know, and I had an interesting conversation with one of the CT instructors out of Sunnyside School District. He was an automotive instructor, and he says many, if not most, of his students go on to the university in engineering. But goodness, what a foundation. They've been messing around with engines for years. They know how to hold tools. They get how all the components of a system work together. What a fantastic foundation to set them up for success if they go into engineering. Or if they don't want to go into the engineering, they are passionate about cars, that's the work they want to do, they can now figure that out, but they're in just much better position to move forward.
Things are a lot different with cars these days. You practically need a computer science degree to work on
Absolutely.
Them. But it sounds like you are giving them those skills. How many students are you serving?
So that's a great question. Total CTE students in our district, our service delivery area for JTED goes all the way up to Mammoth San Manuel and Pinal County. It goes all the way down to the border in Nogales. It goes all the way out to Ajo in the west and over to Vail in the east and everything in between. In total, we serve over 30,000 students in career and technical education in that space. Now, most people, when we say that, their eyebrows get a little crinkly because what they think of when they think of JTED are the campuses that we own and operate that are central campuses here in the Tucson area, including our beautiful buildings down at the Bridges, masterpieces up at River and Shannon, and over on the east side at Camino Seco and 22nd. Those are campuses that have a model where students come to us in the afternoon from whatever their school day looks like. Might be homeschool, might be public school, might be private school, might be charter school. But they come in the afternoons and participate in our after-school programming.
About how many days a week?
Oh, well, it depends on the program. Some of our more intense programs might be 4 hours a day, 4 days a week. These kids don't mess around. They're not playing. Other programs might be 3 hours a day, 2 days a week. It just depends on what sort of certifications they're going for. But it's a really intense program. And the reason why both those models exist, why JTED serves the award-winning welding program up in Marana High School, as well as it serves the Mel and Enid Zuckerman Center for Health and Medical Careers down at the Bridges, the reason why we do both is because some programs are really expensive to run. If there's, you know, our nursing programs, licensed nursing assistant program is a heavy lift for a district. Some of our engineering labs and the equipment that goes into them, certainly automotive, some of our some of our programs in cosmetology. Those are very expensive labs to run. And so then rather than have every high school try and make their own, there's some centralized programs where any student can come and participate. And so that's, you know, that's one of the big decision points in when we look at what programs go into the central campuses versus are supported by our member districts and their satellite campuses.
And, you know, I took a tour of that Bridges. You were kind enough to show me around the Bridges campus, and I was blown away by the size of it and the incredible number of, I mean, you have a commercial kitchen.
It's gorgeous.
Over there. You have film studios. Mm-hmm. You have welding bays. A vet clinic, and where you actually have people can bring their animals mm-hmm. in when you guys are open for special events.
We do spay and neuter, wellness checks.
And a little health clinic
Absolutely.
As well, where you guys had a health fair, I think, last month.
Mm-hmm.
Had a health fair out there. So it's really, talk a little bit about, and we've got about a minute before we have to take a break here, but can you talk about the Bridges campus?
Oh, sure.
And yeah, relatively recently opened, right?
We're very proud of that campus. It's gorgeous. And it is really a testament to the trust that the community has put in us. So there are two buildings there now. One opened in 2020. Our most recent, the Health and Medical Center, opened in just this past school year. So that's still got the new building smell on it. Very exciting. But those are both really living structures that represent the trust and faith that the community has put in us. There are massive investments from our business partners, from our philanthropic friends here in Tucson. Most of that money came from our community because they recognize the need to strengthen the workforce pipeline for these young people today.
All right. We're going to take a quick break here. My guest is Merrill Kemp Wilcox. We're talking about Pima JTET.
Are you ready to immerse yourself in a diverse culture while wandering through bustling markets, sampling exotic cuisines, or forging connections with people from all walks of life? Well, Bon Voyage Travel is here to plan your perfect journey. Whether you're setting off on a solo expedition, embarking on a group adventure, or simply dreaming of far-off destinations, we can help create your custom experience. The road ahead is filled with endless possibilities. Visit bvtravel.com to find your specialized Bon Voyage Travel advisor today.
Noble Hops is Tucson's original gastropub, serving an ever-changing menu of craft beer and fine fare. Savor the majestic mountain views from the perfect for any season spacious patio at West Lambert Lane and North La Cañada Drive in Oro Valley. Order in or take out at Noble Hops, a pub for foodies. On the web at noblehops.com. For more than a half century, Tucson Gardeners Trust Green Things, a family-owned and operated retail and wholesale plant nursery, offering an amazing variety of plants, trees, cacti, pottery, and so much more, all at great prices. The 13.5-acre site by the Rialto River is also home to the Zocalo Village, specializing in fine Mexican and Latin American imported furniture and art. Green Things open daily at 3384 East River Road and at greenthingsaz.com and zocalovillage.com.
The Friends of Pima Animal Care Center is the nonprofit partner to our Pima County Animal Shelter. We grant critically needed resources to PACC so that it can continue the amazing life-saving progress it has made in recent years. Your generosity helps us find homes for abused, neglected, and abandoned animals at PAC. Learn how you can help at friendsofpacc.org.
Are you happy with the news you get? While not all news is good news, you know good reporting when you see it. Check TucsonSentinel.com every day for breaking news and investigative reports. Have your say in the comments. It's all in TucsonSentinel.com, your local, independent, nonprofit news. You can rely on TucsonSentinel.com for solid reporting about immigration, Tucson and Pima politics, everything from the border to baseball. It's independent news without the spin. TucsonSentinel.com. We are watching Tucson.
Hi, this is Irene Coppola, President and CEO of the Better Business Bureau serving Southern Arizona. The BBB sets the standards for marketplace trust by engaging with and educating consumers and businesses. The BBB is the resource to turn to for the objective, unbiased information on businesses offering national and local consumer services online and in person. Learn more about the many services offered by the Better Business Bureau at bbb.org.
We're back with the Buckmaster Show, broadcasting from the Green Things Zocalo Village Studio. I'm Jim Nintzel, Government and Political Impact Reporter with the Tucson Sentinel. And I want to remind our listeners that since 1970, Green Things has been the go-to place for your gardening needs. Green Things is on a lovely 13-acre site that is also home to the Zocalo Village and all of those fine Mexican and Latin American imported furniture and art. Green Things on River Road, just west of the Brandy Fenton Park, and on the web at greenthings.com, greenthingsaz.com, excuse me, and zocalovillage.com. We're going to continue our conversation with Merrill Kemp Wilcox, the Director of Research and Development from the Pima JTED, and we're talking about career and technical education for high school students in Southern Arizona. Can you share, we've got about 4 minutes left, can you share some success stories with us?
Oh my goodness, I love talking about our students. Our students are the reason for the whole thing. Listen, I'm a big believer that if you give people the tools and the opportunity and let them loose, they will knock your socks off, and our kids are the living embodiment of that. One of my favorite stories to tell is of a young woman who was in our robotics and automation program and in our healthcare foundations program. So those are two really different programs, right? One is health and medical and one is engineering-y, making robots do things. And when asked about it, she said, well, yeah, I want to make prosthetics. And she's 16, 17 years old, and she knows that and is figuring out how to do it. I mean, that's amazing. This girl's going to change the world. And then, of course, we have other students. I'm thinking of Marta. She's a young lady I know. And she is in our culinary arts program, which is fantastic. Teaches them everything from, like, management and menu planning, as well as cooking, as well as catering. She's got the whole, you know, comprehensive piece. And she's in the drone program. And if you ask her, she says it's because she doesn't know what she wants to do yet. And so she wants to try it all out and see what there is to see. You stretch her horizons a little. And I just think that's such a great, both of those, example of what can be done with career and tech ed.
She could be perhaps cooking food for individual homes, and the drones can deliver the meals.
We live in that future. That day is coming.
I don't doubt it. Where do you get your instructors from?
Well, all of our instructors come from industry, which is a broad statement. And in practice, what that means is it can be really hard sometimes. Because I don't know if you know this, but we are a public education district. And so we pay what public education districts pay. And we are looking for folks like engineering instructors and professional cybersecurity folks and nurses and such. And so it can be a struggle sometimes to figure out who the right fit is, who has the passion for igniting the next generation, and is at a point in their life where they're okay with the money they'll make. It's always an issue. We're always looking, any industry listening, we're always looking for partners on this. If you want to lend us your welders or your engineers or your nurses, help them help us help you by supporting that workforce pipeline.
And you get a lot of money from private donors to help support you, such as with the construction of that extraordinary Bridges campus over there on Park and Ajo area. But you also get funding from property taxes here.
A little bit. We get a little bit of property tax funding, which is the mechanism that opens up our programming to all students. Everybody pays into property tax, so everybody gets access to JTED. But the main source of funding is really through enrollment, seat time. When students are in our classes, then money funnels through the Arizona Department of Education back in to the programs to support that. And so it is. We're certainly always, you know, for projects like building a new building, we need some additional support, all, you know, for this heavy lifts like that. But most of our, it's a public education district.
Folks want to know more about it? Where do they find more information?
Absolutely. They go to www.pimajted.org or they reach out to me directly. I'm Meryl. I would be happy to answer any questions. Find us on the web and look out for us. And come visit. We have our big completion ceremony at Keno this Friday. And so anybody, if you got family, if you got young people who are it's a very exciting time of year in general for schools and for students. But we got about 1,000 young kids going to get their name called out to celebrate all their hard work that they put in to get through some pretty intense and exciting programs.
Oh, congratulations on that. And I'm sure there are more stories to tell, but we're going to have to take a break here. So thank you so much, Meryl Kemp Wilcox, for coming in here and telling us a little bit about JTED.
Hey, thank you so much. And thanks all of your listeners for your support. JTED is proud to represent you.
Cushman & Wakefield PICOR is Tucson's leading independently owned full-service commercial real estate company. Founded in 1985, Cushman & Wakefield PICOR offers leasing, sales, and property management for industrial, office, medical, retail, land, and investment properties in Tucson and Sonora, Mexico. Visit our website at PICOR.com for the latest news from Tucson's commercial real estate sector. That's PICOR.com. Call us at 748-7100. Family owned and run since 1985, Moe's Gallery and Fine Framing is the gold standard for quality and professionalism for picture framing, custom frame mirrors, art for your walls, and hanging and lighting solutions. Come in for your design session or set it up electronically. Moe's Gallery and Fine Framing, Fort Lowell and Dodge, and now doing e-commerce at moesgallery.com.
The Regional Transportation Authority invests over $100 million annually in transportation improvements in the greater Tucson region based on public input. The RTA and its regional partners deliver roadway, transit, safety, pedestrian, bicycle, environmental, and other needed improvements to meet the demands of transportation network users over a 20-year period. Learn more about the economic and quality of life benefits of the RTA's 2006 voter-approved plan and flexible funding at rtamobility.com. Located in the heart of Arizona wine country, about an hour south of Metro Tucson, Flying Leap Estate Vineyards Winery and Distillery Facilities are one of the most beautiful wine venues in the southwestern United States. Come relax and unwind at our spacious property and learn about Arizona grape viticulture and winemaking from our team of trained sommeliers and discover the intricacies of the art of distillation. Learn more at flyingleapvineyards.com. The nonprofit Tucson Wildlife Center has been helping injured, sick, and orphan wildlife in southern Arizona since 1999. They're dedicated to the rescue, medical care, and rehabilitation of sick, injured, and orphan wildlife, with the goal of releasing them back to their natural habitat. Around 5,000 animals a year come to them, as they are the only wildlife rescue in southern Arizona. All made possible through donations. They receive no government funding. Please donate at TucsonWildlife.com.
Travel is in my DNA. When I'm ready to start another adventure, my trip begins and ends at our local airport, Tucson International Airport. TUS is nonstop for our community and Southern Arizona. TUS, where it's made easy to fly. Start planning now for your next air adventure by visiting flytucson.com.
Welcome back to the Buckmaster Show, broadcasting from the Green Things Zocalo Village Studio. I'm your guest host, Tucson Sentinel Government and Political Impact Reporter Jim Nintzel, and I'm filling in for Bill as he takes a much-needed break. I'm joined now by authors Lisa Schnebly-Heidinger and Julie Morrison, whose new book is Arizona Friend Trips, Stories from the Road. It explores the Grand Canyon State in poetry, Prose and Photography. It's published by University of Arizona Press. But before we start talking about Arizona, we need to talk quickly about New Mexico, because our friends in Silver City and Grant County are ready to welcome you back with open arms. It's just 3 hours east of Tucson. There's so much to do in Silver City and Grant County, New Mexico, including hiking in the Gila National Wilderness and visiting the world-famous Cliff Dwellings National Monument. For a complete listing of the many things to do and great places to stay, visit southwestnewmexico.org. And now let's talk with our authors, Julie and Lisa. Thank you guys for joining us.
Happy to be here.
And Julie, let's start with you. And when I talked to you about this earlier, and we do have an excerpt from the book in the Tucson Sentinel this week, folks want to go and read a little bit about it. But you mentioned, as when we talked about this, you really don't see this as a travel book. It's more about the people and places and things that you guys have memories about and what makes them special. When you set about writing this.
That's right. When we thought about this book, the last thing we were going to do is take inventory of hotels and restaurants and mile markers. Our thought was, let's go to places that one or both of us have experienced and have a compelling memory about and share it with the other. And so we jumped in the car a lot of times with no more plan than let's go there. and we did what interested us. We talked on the way, we talked coming home. A lot of the book is conversational, and so it sort of in that way, in that it also has quotes, and you know, Lisa's essays will reference some of what we talked about. My poems will sometimes reference the subjects that came up. This is much more kind of a backseat experience of our road trips than it is any kind of formal guide.
And you're both third generation Arizonans, so you have deep roots in this state. Lisa, was there anything that surprised you while you were working on this book?
Oh, Jim, I think travel done right is full of surprises. I think one of the things that surprised me was one of my favorite places, the Arizona State Capitol, was one of Julie's least favorite places. And conversely, the one of my least favorite was Walnut Canyon, which is one of her favorites.
Walnut Canyon up in Flagstaff.
Yeah. Correct.
Yeah, yeah. Let me ask you this first, Julie. Do you have a favorite spot in Arizona that you were more excited than others to visit on this trip?
So in the book, I would tell people to go to Hannigan Meadow because it is the least Arizona of the cliched Arizona on brochure covers that you can possibly experience, because you'll see signs for things like snowmobile crossings. And you will see elk in the middle of, you know, a lush green meadow. And that is simply not the, you know, lowland Sonoran desert with the, with the dragging donkey and old prospector that we see in the postcards. But I would also say, you know, outside of the book, if people have only one day, to go to Mount Lemmon with it, because you will see all of the nature that is available in Arizona from the bottom to the top of that mountain.
And Lisa, you mentioned the Arizona Capitol being one of your favorite places, and I imagine you're a rare Arizonan who feels that way, but are there other spots that you want to highlight while we're talking here?
I would suggest going to Lee's Ferry at Marble Canyon. And I say that because people are not inclined to do that. You have to go all the way up 89A toward the North Rim. But to me, it is just a magical, sacred space. Lee's Ferry was where John D. Lee brought people across on the honeymoon trail, and his wife Emma had a little shack there. And of course, Sedona is great. The peaks are great. Lawns at the Hermosa in Phoenix is great. There, how do you pick a favorite?
Yeah, well, that, I guess we don't really have to, which we're lucky about. But yeah, Lee's Ferry. I did a rafting trip from the dam down to Lee's Ferry, and boy, that was really a spectacular journey. A couple summers back.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And Julie, one of the things you mentioned was that you weren't that excited about the south rim of the Grand Canyon, but the north rim blew you away.
Yes, that's right. For me, the south rim is a study in red, both physically and sort of spiritually. The crowds can kind of make you nuts. The traffic, the sense of, I'm in this incredible place with thousands of my, least closest friends. whereas the North Rim, for me, was much more intimate. It was various colors of purple. I have never seen a landscape in purple. I mean, everything from the clouds to the rocks to the air in the canyon seems like a different shade. I just found to be spectacular and stunning, and which is actually not to disparage the South Rim, because I know how important it is to many people, but context is everything. And on the times when I went, I just felt I had a couple kind of nasty things happen to me there, and sometimes we just don't get over our own experience to be able to see the scene in front of us.
Yes, well, hopefully some therapy will help you with the healing there. But the North
I
Rim,
I appreciate that. Thank you.
the North Rim is it's a little challenging to get up there.
Oh no! Yes, no argument here. You have to want to get there. It is. You go to Lee's Ferry and you turn left and you keep going, and then you turn left again to come up the hill and through the burnout, and it is. And then into, Living Forest again. And depending on where you're coming from, this is multiple hours and not many services per hour to drop in on. And then you're either camping there or staying somewhere close by. I mean, this is not the trip for somebody. This is not the drop-in place for someone who's trying to see the Southwest in 3 days. And so it would come at the exclusion of something else or possibly anything else that you wanted to do that weekend. But yeah, it's remote, but it is absolutely worth it in my not so humble opinion.
Lisa, can you talk a little bit? Oh, sorry. Didn't mean to jump on you there.
No, not at all. If I can just quickly interject, if somebody doesn't have that kind of time and doesn't want to hate the South Rim as Julie did, I get up at dark 100 and try to be at the El Travar Hotel there on the rim when they open for breakfast at 7. And it's pretty quiet at 7 a.m. And if you can get a table looking out at the canyon as the shadows deepen and fill in, and they have amazing breakfasts, that might ameliorate some of the crowdedness.
That sunrise at the canyon is pretty spectacular.
Yeah.
And to be as fair as possible, something I haven't experienced. Full disclosure, I haven't seen it at its very best.
Well, it sounds like another trip is on your horizon then.
Always.
After the therapy and the healing
takes
place.
Okay, or en route, maybe a podcast.
Yeah,
yes.
Well, that's true, because you guys have launched a podcast since getting this book together, haven't you?
We have, yes, called Celebrating Arizona.
And what's it all about? I mean, it's about celebrating Arizona, but tell us some of the things we'll hear on the podcast.
We sort of continue the format of the book in that we each react to a place, although in the book we react to the same place. In the podcast, we each bring a place and a story from there. And then we bring a reading from something that we or somebody else that we admire has written that pertains to that place in some way.
And that's available on all your favorite podcast platforms as
yes,
search for Celebrating Arizona.
Yes.
And it sounds like, it's a high-tech, new, fangled 21st century Arizona highways.
I love that comparison.
We'll take that.
Yeah, that's beautiful. Thank you very much.
Lisa, what are you hoping people take away from the book?
From the book?
Yeah.
The desire to go see someplace, either in the book or not. My favorite idea is that the book would end up kind of rumpled and coffee stained and full of folded corners because somebody shoved it under the car seat and then started traveling.
Yeah, well, then clearly it's an artifact that has been used, and yeah, I can't imagine
exactly.
A higher compliment to an author.
Exactly.
Can you talk a little bit about how the book came together in our last 3 minutes or so here?
Julie, it was your idea.
Yeah, through a conversation, I very boldly suggested to Lisa when I had a grand total of nothing published and she had 10 books that maybe we should write something together. And she was kind enough to not only entertain the notion, but then read some of the writing that I was doing. I was in Tucson and just infatuated with the University of Arizona Poetry Center and with poetry and kind of what its superpower of being able to say more in a line than you can in a paragraph. And so I'm writing poems and, you know, Lisa's writing everything. And over time, and especially when COVID hit, we decided, well, one of the things we can do together is, you know, sort of be each other's pod and get together and go to these places. And especially if they're close to where we live. So over the course of 4 or 5 years, that's what we did.
And Lisa, just a little fun trivia fact. Your great-grandma was named Sedona, and the town of Sedona is named after her.
Indeed. My great-grandpa, T.C. Snubley, brought her out in about 1901. And since he was the first postmaster, he got to decide what it should be called, and he chose his wife.
Wow. That is a high compliment. Indeed, to a union to have that legacy behind you. And you guys not only talk to the people who live in all these places, but also to you look at some of the pioneers who founded them.
Yes. Yeah, there's some history stirred in there, here and there.
Due to Lisa far more than me. Yes.
it seems like, you know, traveling Arizona, you guys really did look to tell stories about the people who live here as you engaged in your research.
Good. I'm glad you pulled that out. Yes, I think so.
And I'd say that nearly any story is about people, ultimately. So, or it seems that way to me. So perhaps that's at least my bias showing through.
Yeah, as we talked about earlier, it wasn't about hotel rooms and directions to any of these places. It's about exploring them and discovering who lives there and why these places are important to them.
That's right. And, you know, at the risk of comparing people to something inanimate, you know, each person brings a different window on that place. And so, you know, I think that's part of the richness of traveling with another person and going to see things. And then also speaking to people in those places or, you know, relating what happened to you with other people when you were there. All of these are different windows coming together for a much more multidimensional view.
Well, it's a wonderful book. I certainly hope folks out there are going to pick it up. If they're interested in learning more, as we said, you've got the podcast Celebrating Arizona. And I just want to thank you guys for writing such an extraordinary book about the state of Arizona.
Oh, that's generous. And thank you for letting us talk to you again.
It's very kind of you.
Thank you.
And there is an excerpt from Arizona Friend Trips in the Tucson Sentinel. this week. So be sure to pick that up or pick it up. Be sure to go online to TucsonSentinel.com and give it a read. You talked about Sonoyta, which, Julie, you spent a lot of time in Sonoyta, I think, as a kid, right?
I've been to, yes, I did. I went to the Sonoyta Quarter Horse Show many a summer. And that's, again, a view on the Sonoyta that many people wouldn't have. Yeah.
And it was all new to you, Lisa.
I'd been to Sonoyta, but I'd never done the quarter horse experience. And it was fascinating to listen to Julie and the track guy talk about this famous quarter horse buried there. And it's so many things, Jim, as you know, being a reporter, is a window into a world that we're not familiar with.
All right. We're going to have to leave it there. It's our show for today. My thanks to my guests, authors Lisa Schnebly-Heidinger and Julie Morrison, whose new book, Arizona Friendship, Story from the Road, is now on stands. Also, thanks to author Gary Paul Nabham, author of Against the American Grain.